I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East, where tomorrow the UAE prepares to host global leaders at the World Government Summit 2025. Like other GCC countries, the UAE condemned what Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman called a genocide in Gaza, widely seen as a tactical, strategic, moral and military defeat for Zionism. Israel's US-UK EU-armed genocide architect Netanyahu is actually due back in court today for corruption, not genocide, just days after sitting beside Trump in Washington when the US president proposed the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. As for NATO-backed violence, it continues in this region, with Israel's mass killing in Lebanon, the West Bank, let alone Syria, now in the throes of partition between Turkey, Israel and Al-Qaeda-linked groups. But while most of the world sees Israel's actions for what they are, it's not so in the countries arming Israel. To criticize Israel in NATO countries is seen as anti-Semitic, even if you are Jewish. And Jews around the world have been at the forefront of opposition to the genocide. Being Jewish after the destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning, is the new volume from Professor Peter Beinart, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. He joins me now from New York. Professor Beinart, thank you so much for coming on. You say in the new book, it's about the story Jews tell themselves to block out the screams. We're in the week of a Jewish holiday, Tu Bishvat, if I pronounce that correctly, 1 month from something called Purim. Tell me why you write about Purim and its relevance to the Gaza genocide.
Sure. So on Purim, Jews read the Book of Esther from the Hebrew Bible. And the Book of Esther is a famous story. It's the story in Persia, in which this figure called Haman tries to organize a genocide, a destruction of the Jews. And that's usually the way the story is told, certainly in the United States, this story of a kind of an attempted genocide against the Jews and survival. And of course, given that Jews not so long ago indeed were the victims of a genocide in Europe, this story is very, very resonant for many people. The point I try to make in the book is that the story is more complicated than that, because it ends, in fact, with the power dynamic being reversed and the Jewish leader Mordechai overseeing a kind of massacre of the Jews' adversaries. And the point I try to make is that Jewish sacred texts actually portray Jews in a whole range of different ways, in the full complexity that we have as human beings, as victimizers and as victims. We can be in both roles, like any other group of human beings can be. But I think this part of our own tradition is often actually kind of blocked out in contemporary discourse, which I think is related to the fact that in much Jewish discourse, the story of Israel-Palestine is put within this framework of the historic oppression of the Jewish people, which makes it harder for us to see some of the realities that actually exist.
Yeah, I mean, we've had ministers in Israeli cabinets. We've had the former Israeli prime minister on this show. I think he walked out. They usually walk out for some reason. We had Ehud Barak on. Why do you think they don't see that the most dangerous place in the world to be a Jew now is Israel?
Well, I think the trauma of Jewish history leading to the idea that a Jewish state, a state in which Jews hold power, that Jews rule, would be a response that would keep Jews safe after the Holocaust was, I think, in some ways an understandable impulse. Even someone like Edward Said, the great Palestinian intellectual who was a fierce critic of Zionism, said he could understand the experience and the impulse from which this movement came. The problem is that when you deny people basic human rights, as Israel does towards the Palestinian people in a variety of different ways, holding them under military rule in the West Bank, holding them under blockade in Gaza, all of the refugees who were expelled in 1948 and 1967, that is a system of structural violence. And when you impose that violence on people, we know from political science literature that actually it makes a country less safe for everybody. So the core contention in my book is that Jews are safer under conditions of legal equality than we are under conditions of legal supremacy.
Yeah, and other people do make that point, but perhaps no book is more dangerous to Zionist Jews than your book, because you use scripture, historical scripture, to show how it has been manipulated in synagogues, if I'm getting that right, to kind of create an idea of what being a Jew is, to help the conflation between being a Jew and being someone who's able to commit genocide?
Well, I think that Judaism is a vast religious tradition. So like Christianity and Islam, it speaks in many, many different voices, right? But I think that what has happened in recent decades is that this ethno-nationalist project in some ways has swallowed up in many Jewish communities some of Judaism's more universalistic message about the universal infinite dignity of all people. I think this is something that seems to be happening more broadly around the world. When I look at many white Christians in the United States, I'm really struck in the Trump era by how they seem to think that the only human beings who have any value in the world are people who have American passports. As I understand Christianity, that's really not Christianity's message at all, right? But it's a kind of way in which Christianity has been swallowed by a kind of ethno-nationalism. And I think we see in Judaism, tragically, in certain Jewish communities, a similar dynamic in which allegiance to this state and its project of Jewish domination over Palestinians is actually considered to be more important than certain core principles of Judaism itself. Again, the core principle that all human beings are created in the image of God, and therefore all human beings have inherent value and dignity.
Yeah, and going back to what you said about Purim, the moral, you say, is that it's not just the danger of Gentiles to Jews, it's the danger that Jews pose to Gentiles. But as you write about this, you had to preface the book with the threats ranged against you for thinking the way you do about the Gaza genocide?
Well, I wouldn't say threats. I mean, I live, compared to certainly people in Gaza and many other people around the world, and even compared to Israeli Jews, I live a very, very safe and privileged life in the United States. So I wouldn't say that I face threats. I do think that when you strongly criticize Israel and raise questions about the very legitimacy of a state that privileges Jews over Palestinians in Jewish communities in the United States and around the world, you're likely to get very, very fierce pushback. And I think, you know, nobody likes a turncoat, a traitor, right? There is a sense in Jewish tradition that we imagine ourselves Jews as a kind of a family. And people tend not to like the person in the family who is accusing others in the family of doing really bad things. But to me, this is a tradition of dissent that's necessary in any society, in any community, and that we Jews also have this tradition of dissent in our own tradition. And it's one that I think must be continued, because what Israel is doing is profoundly morally wrong, it seems to me, by universal moral standards, but also by, according to what I consider to be Judaism's own best traditions.
And why do you think, for the most part, watching oligarch-run media in your country and in other NATO countries, the countries supplying the weapons for the genocide, people like you don't seem to really exist, apart from the odd protester, because, of course, it must be made clear that Jews have been at the forefront of protests in the United States and in Britain and in European countries against what's been happening in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think, unfortunately, oligarchs controlling media institutions is only a NATO phenomenon. I think that, sadly, that exists all over the world. I think that the discourse about Israel in the United States has generally, been a discourse in which Palestinians have not had what Said famously called permission to narrate, in which Palestinians have not really been full-fledged members.
But I'm not even talking about Palestinians. I mean, on Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, which Trump apparently watches daily, there are no Jews that are anti-Zionist on Fox News.
No, that's true. I mean, I think part of the way one needs to understand this, I think, is that Israel's founding myths are very similar to America's founding myths. These are both nations that think of themselves as kind of promised lands forged on a hostile frontier. So if you're talking about Fox News and the American right, which are deeply invested in America's founding myths and would fiercely resist any effort to reckon with what the United States did in the 19th century to its native population, it's not surprising that they would also be very sympathetic to Israel's founding myths as well, and very hostile to any critical interrogation of that.
And would you go so far as to say that supporting what Israel did is to be anti-Jewish in a way?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't say that because I don't think that one can essentialize what it means to be Jewish or to be just like or any other religious tradition. The truth is that these religious traditions have always spoken in a multiplicity of voices, and different people have interpreted those traditions in different ways. What I would say is that my understanding of being Jewish is one that emphasizes the ethical message within Judaism of human dignity. And I believe that what Israel has done is an affront to that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Tehran. There's a big Jewish, you know, there's quite a Jewish community in Tehran. They oppose Israel.
Right. Although
completely.
not one that has freedom, because nobody in Iran has true freedom. Right.
Well, one could have a big argument about what freedom means, of course. But in Iran, they're very...
Right. Not the freedom if you want to protest against the government.
Right. Actually, talking about protests against the government, what have you made of the fact that all visas for protesters, for foreign students are going to be... It may affect your university. They're going to be deported.
No,
and, of course, the use of tear gas and violence against protesters in your country. About Gaza.
Yes. I mean, there's no question that there's been growing amounts of repression, started under Biden, but it's escalated under Trump, of protesters who support Palestinian rights. And so it's gotten worse. And the people who are most vulnerable to this are those who are not U.S. citizens. And of course, this is part of Trump's larger crackdown against Americans who are not U.S. citizens. But this excuse that pro-Palestinian protesters are pro-Hamas is a way of stripping them of their rights. And I think we're going to look at this period as one of the periodic and terrible periods of repression of American civil liberties. There were the Palmer raids of the early 1920s, the McCarthy period of the 1950s. And now I think, sadly, we're entering into another era like that.
Although it was there during the Biden-Blinken, we call him Genocide Joe Butcher Blinken, era too. It was Trump that stopped the aerial bombardment of Gaza. We must
right,
emphasize.
But the repression of pro-Palestinian protesters is now getting worse under Trump. So Biden and Blinken, although I think their policies were horrifying in terms of the unconditional support, military support for Israel, they did not threaten to deport students on visas at American universities who were protesting against Israel's destruction of Gaza.
Albeit,
Trump is doing that.
Albeit the lack of a First Amendment rights that happened during the Biden administration, Facebook posts and so on. Has it affected you that when you talk about Gaza, Facebook posts, Twitter posts? Before Elon Musk.
No, it hasn't. Look, I mean, the United States under Donald Trump is becoming a less free society. And for people who wanted to protest for Palestinians, there have always been greater restrictions than on people who wanted to protest in some other ways. But it's also still the case that it was possible for people, over the last year and a half to organize mass protests in the United States against this war. And for the most part, people were able to do that without being locked up.
Quite a few people were locked up, though. Peter Beinart, I'll stop
right,
you there.
I mean, maybe.
I'll stop
right,
you there.
But not in the way you would, right. Not in the way you would be in a truly authoritarian regime where you would be put in some prison for a decade. Go ahead.
Peter Beinart, I'll stop you there. More from the author of Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Peter Beinart, the editor-at-large of Jewish Currents and professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. Professor, I was interrupting you there when you were defending your free rights and freedom in the United States, something that we've examined on this program in great detail. And I don't know, arguably it's not quite as free as you suggest, nor as it has been. But, of course, another criticism of your book could be that while you blame Israel, which, as you said before, has some kind of excuse because the Jews who inhabit it are the descendants of those who suffered the Holocaust in Europe, not so much blame of the NATO countries arming Israel. There's no way Netanyahu and those IDF soldiers could have done what they did without the weapons that came from your country and NATO countries. Do you not think
yes.
that you're putting too much of the blame on these Zionist settlers and Jews in Israel when they couldn't have done anything like what they did do without Biden, obviously, and European and British governments.
Sure. No, I've been very critical of the United States government for its unconditional military support and diplomatic support for Israel, including during this Gaza's destruction. So I entirely agree with you. Part of my argument, especially made to Jews in the United States, is that we need to act in the United States to try to be part of a movement to change U.S. policy.
And what do you think has happened with this? Obviously, it is the worst, the genocide of our century. It's been called the Holocaust. What is it? What effect has it had on Jewish Americans? Because polls have shown that Jews in the United States do sympathize with some of the issues in your book, whereas before we would never have seen anything like that.
Yeah, I think the term genocide is. I think there's good reason to believe the term genocide applies. I would resist the term Holocaust because I think that suggests the genocide of Jews that took place in Nazi Germany was very different in many ways from what's happening to Palestinians as in Gaza, as horrifying.
Burning to death.
I don't think it does anyone any good to try to make those historical equivalencies. The point is that genocide has an international legal definition. So we can apply it to what was done in Rwanda. We can apply it to what's being done in Xinjiang. We can apply it to what's being done in Gaza.
I'm not sure about Xinjiang. People can watch our show about Xinjiang and how USAID manufactured that.
Right.
Let's go to another.
No, I know that the Chinese. I know that there are people who defend the Chinese government's human rights abuses as well, just like the people defend human rights abuses.
I'm not defending the Chinese government by any standard.
But I think that what you see among American Jews is a division of opinion in which. The kind of Jewish institutions that have the most power tend to support Israel unconditionally, but that there is a growing group of Jews, particularly younger American Jews, who I think see what Israel's doing as an affront to their basic values, the values of the kind of progressive values that they hold as progressive Americans and as progressive Jews.
Of course, the book clearly states comparisons, as you said earlier in part one, about what the United States Protestants did to Native Americans, but you compare directly Palestinian resistance to the IRA in Ireland and the ANC in South Africa. Of course, that's a case for violence, clearly. I mean, I've interviewed Nelson Mandela. Mandela clearly supported, against the views of the South African Communist Party, the killing of civilians in restaurants. What do you think the impact of your book is for Jews who live in Israel in the sense that violence must be part of the struggle, if indeed it can be compared with Ireland and South Africa?
I think that there is a very important distinction between violence against military targets and violence against civilians. I think that's a very important distinction in international law. I think it's a very important moral distinction.
But why do you think Mandela was successful and the IRA was successful?
Nelson Mandela and the ANC actually worked quite hard to maintain that distinction, even going so far as apologizing for attacks against civilian sites. The Pan-Africanist Congress and other of the ANC's rivals were more open to attacks on civilians. But I think one of the things that the ANC deserves a lot of credit for was that
later on, it should be said.
I mean, no,
from its turn to violence
in the 1960s. If one of the ANC was far, far more scrupulous about attacks on civilians than Hamas has been. Hamas, going back to the 1990s, with its continued attacks on pizzerias, on buses, and now on October 7th, has been far more willing to attack and target civilians, which I think is deeply unfortunate and, to me, in my mind, unethical and immoral.
Yeah, I think violence, political violence, is always up for that debate, but it's where you show in the book, in great detail, the kind of massacres that have occurred in colonial struggles. Why do you see it as a colonial settler struggle, like Mau Mau, the Mau Mau movement in Kenya against the British, for instance?
Right. I mean, it's colonial in a very simple sense, in that Palestinians are subjects. Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and most Palestinians in East Jerusalem are subjects of the state, but not citizens. They are under the control of the state, but they are not represented in its government. And I think that's a very simple definition of what colonialism means.
Do you think what's most moving about the book to many people, or could be the most moving to some Jews in Israel, is the fact that you didn't think like this before your 30s? Just tell me a little bit about that and whether Israel is a kind of totalitarian colonial settler state as well, or has elements of it, to be able to make someone like you not realize the everyday existence of Palestinians, even though you were there in Israel, around a mile away.
I don't know that I would. I don't know that I would use the term totalitarian. It's certainly not, but it is a state that Palestinians do live under military law in the West Bank, which means they lack the most basic freedoms, the freedom to move, the freedom of movement, the freedom, right to due process, the right to vote. And it's true that I think, like many other Jews in the United States and elsewhere, my understanding of Israel, my relationship to Israel, was seen through the prism of what Israel meant to Jews within the framework of Jewish history, and especially modern Jewish history and the Holocaust, as a sense of kind of security, knowing that there was a country in the world that always would take Jews in if Jews were in danger. And that was the way that the kind of Israel was narrated to me growing up. I think it took a long time, much, much longer than I wish it had, for me to actually begin to really grapple with what Israel meant for Palestinians, what, as Edward Said called Zionism from the standpoint of its victims. And it was really only in the first time that I, you know, it was only my 30s that I, for the first time, spent time with Palestinians in the West Bank and realized that this system, this state, was much more brutal than I had recognized, and that that the Palestinian experience was one that really forced me to rethink the way I thought about this state.
You mentioned Edward Said, the great Palestinian Christian scholar. Do you think he'd be allowed to teach in the United States today, in the United States? Because we keep getting reports of all sorts of McCarthy-style antics in academia in your country.
No, I think so. You would be allowed to, you know, would be allowed to teach. I mean, Rashid Khalidi at Columbia, who is holds the Edward Said chair and has views which are not so different, has now just taken emeritus status, but was still teaching at Columbia. But I do think that it's when you go from scholarship and teaching to kind of openly confronting the university through activism, through protests and even civil disobedience, that then we've seen that the repression has been quite severe.
And what, I know you clearly don't like Donald Trump, but why do you think it was that it was only Donald Trump that stopped the aerial bombardment of Gaza? These horrific pictures of genocide, you know, hourly, I'm sure you were looking at them too on our phones. It was a live streamed continuous massacres. Trump got it stopped, not the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, I think Netanyahu is scared of Trump in a way that he was not scared of Biden, because Trump is extremely erratic and vindictive, and also that Trump really cares primarily really about himself. And so I think Trump saw that coming into office and having a hostage deal, some kind of ceasefire deal, would make him look good. And Netanyahu wanted to make Trump look good in order to ingratiate himself with Trump.
And of course, he's allied to, I don't know what you think of Mike Huckabee, your ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Israel. You don't really talk about it that much in the book, but this alliance between Christian Zionism and Zionists, who anyway believe that all the Jews have to die anyway on the Day of Judgment.
Well, yes. I mean, that
you can't get more anti-Semitic than that.
You know, I think that the position of the Israeli government about the Christian theology of end times would be, we don't really need to worry about that. We don't think that's going to happen. But I think that to understand white Christian Zionism, you can't see it only through a religious framework. To me, it is very much the expression of America's own settler colonialism. These are people who really mythologize and defend from any criticism America's genocide that America committed in the 19th century, and have a very clear view of kind of hierarchy between different peoples of different races and religious groups. And so I think it's in that framework that one can understand the kind of profoundly racist view that someone like Mike Huckabee has towards Palestinians and towards Muslims and towards many other peoples.
But they never have to get to the nub of the problem there between about Judgment Day and that. I mean, Pete Hegseth's the head of the Pentagon, of course, now.
You know, none of us have seen Judgment Day, so it's a theoretical proposition.
But you think it probably is pretty anti-Semitic?
I think there is anti-Semitism clearly among, there's a strange combination of anti-Semitism and philo-Semitism that you find on the Christian right, which I would say essentially Jews are really beloved when Jews participate in a project that these folks like, which is a project of kind of ethno-nationalist domination. But Jews become adversaries when Jews oppose that project.
And just finally, how long do you think it'll take for the world to fully understand what this 15 months of genocide in Gaza has meant to the world, really?
I mean, I think if you looked at public opinion, a great many people in the world already do recognize that this has been one of the great crimes of the 21st century. The question of whether that will translate into political action by governments that have power, I think is very much an open question, especially because many governments, including my own, are moving in an authoritarian direction in which they're less responsive to public opinion.
If it happens again, you'll write a sequel to Being Jewish, presumably, in the next few months?
God willing, that won't be necessary, but we'll see.
Professor Peter Beinart, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Being Jewish after the destruction of Gaza, a reckoning is out now. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.